You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
On June 20th, 1996, a bayou fisherman in Pope County, Arkansas, reeled in something other than a fish. It was a tennis shoe with a human bone attached. This grisly catch led to the discovery of the remains of the Mueller family, who had been missing for 6 months. As law enforcement officials investigated, they began to focus on a man named Chevy Kehoe as their prime suspect, but some claim he was framed by his own family and wrongly convicted. Here to discuss this intriguing case of murder, domestic terrorism, and racial prejudice is Helen Borton, the award-winning producer of Convicting Chevy Kehoe, part of the radio documentary series A Sense of Place. And joining her is Daniel Medwed, a professor of law at the University of Utah and a member of the board of directors of the Innocence Network and the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center. His book, Prosecution Complex, America's Race to Convict and Its Impact on the Innocent, is published by NYU Press. I'm very pleased to welcome them to our show. Helen, welcome back, Helen. This case made national headlines at the time, and many of our listeners may recall seeing the harrowing gunfight between the Kehoe brothers and police on national television, which was recorded on a dashboard camera in an Ohio State Trooper's cruiser. That was as a result of just a routine traffic stop?
Yes, exactly. That was. And what it did, it shifted the focus on these murders from Kirby Kehoe, who was the father of the two boys in this car, in this vehicle. It shifted the focus from him, who he had been the primary suspect, Kirby, their father, to them, simply because this traffic thing happened.
Well, why did they start shooting at cops? And why not just accept the stop?
Well, that's a great question. Actually, Shane, who is the one who I believe framed his brother, is the one that jumped out of the car and started shooting. Chevy started moving back to the car with his hands up, shouting, "Don't shoot! Don't shoot!" And when his brother started shooting, then Chevy jumped in the car and sped away. In brief, that's kind of what happened.
What kind of family do these brothers come from?
A very sad, sad family. The father was a fanatic, far right-wing extremist, anti-government, believer in something called Christian identity, which basically says that whites should inherit the earth and that everybody else, you know, that Jews are the evil seed of Satan and blacks are simply brutes of the field, that sort of thing.
And this whole family were neo-Nazis and white supremacists? And weren't they also connected to the Aryan Nation?
It depends on who you talk to. Not really. Not technically, no. They simply believed in these things, and farther than that, we cannot go.
Well, Chevy was also a polygamist and even went on a television show called Hard Copy.
Right.
People will know that show, to discuss his views on marriage. Is polygamy common within groups like Christian Identity?
I don't believe so. I really can't answer that question. I don't believe so. This was another very unpopular view that played against him during the trial.
Daniel, in your book, Prosecution Complex, you discuss many things that can influence a criminal trial, one of them being tunnel vision. What's tunnel vision and how does it affect the work of both investigators and prosecutors?
That's an excellent question. Tunnel vision is a very common human impulse, and basically it relates to the idea of locking into a theory about something. Let's say you're a Yankees fan, and you lock into the theory that the Yankees are the best team in the world, and you might discount information that suggests that they're not the best team in the world. It's psychologists often call it the confirmation bias, that once you've developed a hypothesis, you tend to see other evidence through the lens of that theory.
So do you think that – oh, go ahead.
Yes, no, please.
Do you think that Chevy's background had any effect on the police decision to focus on him as a suspect?
I think that's a very fair assumption. Here's somebody who had a somewhat horrific, a very horrific reputation, and was part of a disreputable group. And it's quite possible that there was a frame of reference here that allowed investigators to develop tunnel vision about his potential culpability.
Now, on television shows, the audience is the one with the tunnel vision. We all focus on a certain obvious suspect. And then, of course, at the end, we discover that it was somebody totally different because the cops didn't have tunnel vision. How typical is that in real life?
That's the million-dollar question, or $64 million question. I think it's relatively rare, because tunnel vision is an innate human impulse, as I said, and especially when it relates to overworked and underpaid members of law enforcement who have a tremendous number of cases on their desk, a number of leads to investigate, and once they often have locked into a particular suspect, there are powerful cognitive forces at play that make it very difficult to entertain the possibility of an alternative suspect. I'd like to think that it does happen, Leonard, that once there is that new evidence pointing to suspect B, that the police shift gears and begin to look at suspect B. But I fear that that's relatively rare.
So, Helen, what happened here? So there was the shootout. They arrested him. What was he charged with?
They did not arrest him. Both boys got away. These were two brothers. They both escaped. They got away for, something like, 6 months, something like that. But they stopped looking into the father, Kirby Kehoe, who was the first prime suspect.
The murder of the Mueller family.
The murder of the Mueller.
Why would he have wanted to have killed the Muellers?
Well, in the first place, he was in a feud with Bill. They were both gun dealers. They had gotten into, according to Chevy, an insurance scam. And Kirby had taken the firearms away so that he could report this to the insurance, a robbery. Well, Chevy claims it was an insurance scam, but also the insurance company apparently thought so. They never paid. They never paid Bill Mueller for this. So they were involved together in these gun deals. And then a year later, this killing took place. By that time, according to many different witnesses and Chevy, they were at sword's throat. They were, because he hadn't given back the equipment, the firearms, Bill Mueller. They were afraid of each other at this point. They had been heard threatening each other at this point. So there was motive there for Kirby, but there was really no motive for Chevy, none whatsoever.
And Chevy comes across as almost a reluctant racist. He was kind of when it looked like he wasn't going to go along with the family's view of the world, they took him out of school and then they homeschooled him.
Exactly.
So he's kind of like the, if he's a reflection of his father's views, it was fairly reluctant.
He tried to break away several times. I mean, as a kid, he broke away. He went away from home, and he got a driver's license, which his father forbid, and he got a social security number, which his father forbid, and he got a job at McDonald's, which his father forbid. And he did all this. He was trying to break away from all this. He was a brilliant student. Everybody that dealt with him in those teen years loved him. I mean, his teacher said, this is the kind of student every teacher wants to have.
So how did he become a suspect in the Mueller murders? He's been convicted of 3 counts of murder and also of racketeering charges.
Yes. Well, the racketeering charges, that stems from this gun dealing at gun shows, and the father, Bill Mueller, the boy, they were all involved in this. So that deals with guns that weren't that were carried across state lines, and that's kind of a very separate thing. But let's get into your first question. Why was he considered a suspect? The only reason, the only thing that connects him, is both his mother and his brother Shane saying that he confessed the murders to them. This is where it's at. That's what got him convicted. There was no forensic evidence tying him. There was no motive. But the having a mother and a brother, this hearsay confession, which he and Danny have both denied from the beginning.
Danny Lee is the other
the
person
other co-defender.
Who's been convicted.
Exactly.
He was the accomplice. He was
so-called accomplice, and it was basically, I mean, otherwise it was a very weak case. We have that. We have the prosecutor admitting that. So it was basically the mother and the brother saying, he told me he did it. And these things don't hold. When you read these so-called, these hearsay confessions, they're full of holes.
Well, we are going to take a little break, come back, find out why a family would want to set up one of their own and have him sent to prison for the rest of his life. As we continue this conversation with Helen Borton, who has done a radio documentary called Convicting Chevy Kehoe. It's a part of the A Sense of Place series. Daniel Medwood is the author of Prosecution Complex. He is also a professor of law at the University of Utah and a member of the board of directors of the Innocence Network and the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center. Stay with us for more. We are back with Daniel S. Medwood, professor of law at the University of Utah, member of the board of directors of the Innocence Network and the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center, and author of Prosecution Complex, America's Race to Convict and Its Impact on the Innocent. It is published by NYU Press. And Helen Borton, who has won a Peabody, 2 Emmy Awards, 3 Unity Awards, and many other awards for her work in radio. Her latest is a documentary called Convicting Chevy Kehoe, and it's part of the A Sense of Place series, which is broadcast. Where is A Sense of Place? It's a PBS. I mean, it's an NPR series?
It was PR. The last 2 seasons were PRI, were distributed by PRI.
Yes. Uh-huh. Daniel, during the course of an investigation, police may uncover many facts, some confirming their theories, some not. What rules or laws are in place to govern what materials police and prosecutors have to turn over to the defense?
Gosh, there are a series of rules. Some of them are constitutional and some of them are just legislative. In terms of constitutional rules, there's something called the Brady Doctrine, which requires prosecutors to turn over all evidence that is favorable to the defense or material, that's the legalese version, to guilt or punishment. And so the idea is if there is some evidence that might on the margins exonerate the defendant, then the defense should receive that information. One issue, though, is whether or not the prosecution even has access to that information. That is, it's unclear whether the police always disclose it to the prosecutors to begin with.
Helen, as you mentioned earlier, at Chevy Kehoe's trial, some of the most damaging evidence presented was the testimony of his mother, Gloria, and his brother, Shane. We have a little clip of Chain describing the murders.
Do you know what method was used to kill the Muellers and Sarah?
Yes, sir.
And what was that?
A plastic bag was put over their head and duct taped around so that they would suffocate. I have a little more on that to validate my story, so it's to let you know that it's just not a story. Mr. Mueller, I'm sure the coroner's report shows it, has a crushed-in skull. My brother told me that what happened was he was handcuffed. Mr. Mueller broke the handcuffs. My brother came in and had a shotgun. So he grabbed the shotgun like a club, turned it around and hit him in the back of the head and caved his skull in, from what my brother said.
So this is the only evidence they really have, Helen, is what Shane said. What physical evidence was there to connect Chevy to the crime?
There was none. There was none. And I must mention right here, both Gloria and Shane made a big deal about breaking the stock of the rifle over Mr. Mueller's head and that it caved his skull in. And at the trial, the medical examiner said there was no sign of a recent head injury on the body. There you have one thing that doesn't add up.
Did Chevy have an alibi?
The whole point is that the prosecutor decided there was a very narrow timeline. That was the only time that Chevy and Danny's whereabouts were not accounted for. It was, I think, something like 30 hours when they were anywhere near Arkansas where this happened, you see. And really, no one knew when these people were killed. They had been, their bodies had been in the water for months and months. But the investigation found that Bill Mueller stopped getting his mail, he stopped making phone calls, et cetera, et cetera. He seemed to have disappeared at this certain time. And at that certain time, if you will see on the when the prosecutor talks about his timeline, if the timeline was very narrow, And that was the only time that Chevy and Danny could have done it, because their whereabouts were accounted for. So I don't remember what your previous question was, but if you listen...
Well, I asked if he had an alibi.
His alibi was that he didn't do it, that he was in Oklahoma at the time.
Yes. Now, Mark Hampton, Chevy's defense attorney, discounts his mother Gloria's testimony. We're going to listen to a clip on that.
There was a threat, if she didn't cooperate, that they were going to file an action to try to take custody over the six remaining boys. For the first time in Gloria's life, adult life, she had an income provided by the government for almost 2 years. Some $2,500 a month. This is a woman that's lived in utter poverty all the years that she's been married to Kirby Kehoe. I believe Gloria is a very sick, twisted individual. I think she's been subject to a battered wife syndrome for many years, thanks to Kirby. And yet, she's very manipulative. In a sick, twisted way, she still loved Kirby. So I totally discount anything Gloria Kehoe said during that trial. I totally discount anything she said in the interview she gave law enforcement.
Now, the implication there is that she's willing to sacrifice one of her sons to keep the rest of her kids and not see her husband go to jail.
Well, she was also in terror of her life from her husband. She said she was afraid that Kirby would kill her. I mean, that she knew too much. So she could possibly have been acting under his orders. It's important to know also that Shane, who told this story 9 months before Gloria came forward and told it, himself had a lot to gain by blaming his brother. In the first place, he had become a suspect for the Mueller murders as a result of this shootout. Then, by shooting at police, he got a sentence for that for 24 and a half years, which was reduced in exchange for his testimony at his brother's trial to less than 12, and he's now a free man. So he had a lot to gain by shifting the blame onto his brother.
Daniel, how common is it for people to be convicted of crimes based mainly on this kind of testimony?
It's fairly common. There was one study in 2005 where a professor at the University of Michigan, Samuel Gross, looked at about 340 of these cases, and he concluded that perjured testimony was a factor in about 40% of those cases. So there have been nearly several hundred documented exonerations in which perjury played a significant role.
Then how often are wrongful convictions overturned due to unreliable witness testimony?
Oh, that's a difficult thing to answer.
It seems to me, from what I read, you need DNA evidence, and there's DNA would not play any part in this story, would it?
That's correct. Biological evidence that's suitable for DNA testing appears in approximately only 10 to 20% of cases, usually rapes or murders, the types of crimes that lend themselves to the deposit of biological evidence. So the vast majority of cases do not involve DNA evidence. So right now we know there have been about 300 plus, I think it's 301 or 302 as of today, DNA exonerations. And there have been several hundred other documented non-DNA exonerations. So it's very hard to say how often this occurs. Many of us think that the documented cases are really only the tip of the iceberg because of how difficult it is to achieve an exoneration.
And also, isn't there resistance usually from the prosecutor and often from the judge who was involved?
Regrettably, that's often the case, and that ties into a point you raised earlier, Leonard, about tunnel vision, that tunnel vision often is quite sticky and that it can remain throughout a case. So when you go back to the prosecutors or you go back to the judge years later, sometimes they have retained that original theory, that sense that they got it right the first time around.
Now, Helen, wasn't domestic terrorism also brought into this case?
Yes, it was. I call these two things red herrings. The racism is the red herring, and so is the domestic terrorism.
But this is a racist family, the Kehoes.
Yes, but so were the victims. I mean, that's why it was a red herring. The victims, Bill Mueller and his wife, believed all this same stuff They were in the – as a matter of fact, they said that he had gone to the Aryan Nations compound, which they all believed the same wild extremist stuff. So that's why I call it a red herring. It really didn't have anything to do with that. And the domestic terrorism issue, this was 1 year after the Oklahoma City bombing. And the government spent hours reading from books, many dozens of witnesses, many, many, many days describing in great detail the ugly world of neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and so-called Christian identity. Now, this is before a jury of 9 blacks and 3 whites. Okay, that's no accident, which I'll tell you about later. And I repeat, the murder victims shared these views, you see. So this was dragged in, and actually, to the jury's credit, they were never convicted of this charge of terrorism. But to show how powerful this idea was and how it colored everything, years later, in an appeal for a new trial, the same judge, the judge who presided at the trial, turned down the appeal and cited, quote, Chevy's notorious career as a violent domestic terrorist as one of his reasons for turning down the appeal.
Now, during the sentencing phase of the trial, Chevy, who the jury accepted as the leader of the murder plot, was given 3 consecutive life sentences without parole. But his accused accomplice, Danny Lee, was given the death penalty for his involvement. Is that because Danny Lee had the skinhead appearance?
That's part of it, yes. They made a big deal of it. They showed his whole body. They showed all the, tattoos all over his body, that sort of thing. There was that. There was the fact that he had a long list of juvenile offenses. He had been in and out of reform schools. You don't call them that today, but he had been in and out of that from the age of 12. It was this sort of background, whereas Chevy didn't have any record whatsoever, had no record of violence.
Now, Daniel, is it possible for someone with radical beliefs that most of us find offensive to get a fair trial?
I think it's possible, though it's quite difficult. Obviously, here Chevy had abhorrent, I think I called them horrific, beliefs, and he had this reputation for being involved in the white supremacist movement, though Helen has suggested that maybe the ties aren't as strong as some people thought. I think it's possible, Leonard, depending on how the jury was selected and instructed, but it might be difficult in a case like this or related cases to make sure that you do have a fair trial.
So how difficult is it to get the courts to reevaluate a case of this sort?
I think it's quite difficult for a variety of reasons.
But isn't reasonable doubt a part of our legal system?
Reasonable doubt is part of our legal system. However, after there is a conviction, reasonable doubt is no longer on the table. There is now the presumption of innocence has been converted into a presumption of guilt. So after that adjudication, it becomes infinitely more difficult for the defense to overturn the conviction than it was before that verdict. So doubt is no longer part of the equation, really. The standards are much higher. You often have to show either that it's more likely than not that an injustice occurred, or you have to show by clear and convincing evidence that something really horrific went awry.
But in the case that we have heard so far, it's quite clear that there are all sorts of reasons to doubt Chevy Kehoe's guilt. Wouldn't just a reasonable judge I hear what you're saying. Let's look into this a bit further. Helen?
Okay, I want to talk about the judge. The judge was biased. Anybody that would read the trial transcript would come to this conclusion. He overruled almost every defense objection, and he sustained almost every objection made by the prosecution. That was number one. He scolded and hurried Mark Hampton, the lead defense counsel, to a point where it was humiliating. I'll give you one example which is hair-raising. During Mark's cross-examination of Gloria, now Gloria, you know, she's basically the one that is getting them convicted, during one of the most dramatic moments of the whole trial, as she's making some jaw-dropping remarks at this point, the judge cuts in and told Mark to move it along. Now, he said something like, oh, we've been over this material. Well, this was all new material. We had not been over it. It was shocking, and Mark was very apologetic. We have to understand that the government took over 2.5 months to present its case. The defense took 3 days, and the judge wanted to know how much longer the defense would be, and Mark, still apologetic, he promised to be quick.
Daniel, what reforms can you suggest that would help keep the number of people wrongfully convicted of crimes to a minimum?
Gosh, there are a whole host of reforms. Eyewitness misidentification, which was not an issue in this case, has been documented as the biggest contributor to wrongful convictions, people who simply identify the wrong person. So some scholars have suggested changing the nature or the way in which lineups are conducted, or changing the way in which photo arrays are conducted so as to minimize the risk.
Of course, none of that would apply to this case.
It wouldn't apply. Maybe something that would be helpful here would to, and I'm not sure Helen would probably know the answer to this, whether or not the brother's interrogation, Shane's interrogation, was actually videotaped or was it just audiotaped? Do you know, Helen?
Which interrogation? You're talking about Shane's pretrial interrogation?
Yeah.
To my knowledge, it was only audiotaped.
Audiotaped.
Yes.
So one reform would be to videotape all police interrogations so that judges and perhaps juries could actually evaluate certain nonverbal cues to ascertain whether or not the person's lying or not. It's one thing to hear Shane's voice. It's another thing to actually be able to see his mannerisms and how he gesticulates and whether he's evasive in his appearance. So some people have thought that might be helpful in determining whether or not a person is lying.
Now, what is the current status? Are they both in jail now, or has Danny Lee been executed?
No. Danny is still awaiting an execution date, and Chevy is still in federal prison.
Has he appealed?
And 2 weeks ago, they allowed a hearing in front of the Federal Court of Appeals, hearing for a new trial, which is rather hard to get. It's quite amazing that they – it could take weeks until the – or months until the ruling comes down. Mm-hmm. There are a couple points I'd love to make here, Leonard.
Very quickly.
Okay. Well, if we could play Stripling. No, we can't do that on the timeline.
We're out of time.
Oh, I see. All right. Well, then how much time do I have?
Seconds.
Seconds. Well, Gloria, in her pretrial interview, as much as destroys the timeline that Stripling said his whole case was based on, by saying that the killers hung around for a day or two after the killings. And I told you there was a very narrow timeline. This was never brought out at trial.
But, Helen, you've convinced me that Chevy Kehoe didn't commit this crime. So we don't have to present any more evidence. The real issue
I've
here
got
is...
I've tons of it. I have tons of it, believe me.
The prosecution had 2.5 months, right?
Yeah, I have tons of it.
Well, thank
me.
You both so much for being with us. Helen Borton has done a radio documentary about this case called Convicting Chevy Kehoe. It's part of the A Sense of Place series that is presented by PRI. Daniel Medwood, his book, Prosecution Complex, is published by NYU Press. Thank you both so much for being on our show.
Leonard, thank you
very
so much.